51. Above the jubilee of the coronation, at the top of the needle, Peter stood at a small window looking down. As Thomas had hoped, he had seen and heard everything, from the first cheers when Thomas appeared on Flagg's arm, to the last as he disappeared back into the palace itself, also on Flagg's arm. He stood at the window for nearly 3 hours after the ceremony was over, watching the crowds. They were loath to break up and go home. There was much to discuss and much to relive. This one had to tell that one just where he had been when he heard the old king was dead, and then they both had to tell t'other one. The women had a final good cry over Roland and exclaimed over how fine Thomas had looked and how calm he had seemed. The children chased each other and pretended they were kings and rolled hoops and fell down and skinned their knees and screamed and then laughed and chased each other again. The men clapped one another on the back and told each other that they guessed all would be well now. It had been a terrible week, but now all would be well. Yet through all of this there ran a dull, yellow thread of unease, as if they realized that all was not well, that the things which had gone so wrong when the old king had been murdered were not right yet. Peter, of course, could tell none of this from his high, lonely perch in the needle, but he sensed something. Yes, something. At 3 o'clock, 3 hours early, the mead houses opened, supposedly in honor of the new king's coronation, but mostly because there was business to be had. People wanted to drink and celebrate. By 7 that night, most of the population of the city was reeling through the streets, drinking the health of Thomas the Lightbringer, or brawling with each other. It was nearly dark when the revelers finally began to disperse. Peter left the window, went to the one chair in his sitting room. That name was a cruel joke, and simply sat there with his hands folded in his lap. He sat and watched the room darken. His dinner came, fatty meat, watery ale, and coarse bread so salty it would have stung his mouth if he had eaten any. But Peter did not eat the meat or bread, nor did he drink the ale. Around 9 o'clock, as the carousing in the streets began again, this time the crowds were much more boisterous, almost riotous. Peter went into his prison's second room, stripped to his singlet, washed with water from the basin, knelt by his bed and prayed. Then he got into bed. There was only a single blanket, although the little bedroom was very cold. Peter pulled it to his chest, laced his hands together in back of his head, and looked up into the darkness. From outside and below came screams and cheers and laughter. Now and then there was the sound of firecrackers, and once, near midnight, there was an explosive gunpowder flatulence as a drunken soldier set off a blank charge. The following day, the unfortunate soldier was sent as far east as the kingdom of Delane stretched for his drunken salute to the new king. Gunpowder was rare in Delane and jealously hoarded. Sometime after 1 in the morning, Peter at last closed his eyes and slept. The next morning he was up at 7. He knelt, shivering in the cold, his breath puffing white from his mouth, goosebumps on his bare arms and legs, and prayed. When his prayers were done, he dressed. He went into the sitting room and stood by the window silently for nearly 2 hours, watching the city come to life below him. That coming alive was slower and crankier than usual. Most of the adults in Delane woke with drink-swollen heads. They stumbled to their jobs slowly and in a foul temper. Many of the men went to their tasks blistered by angry wives who had no sympathy with their aching heads. Thomas also had an aching head. He had drunk too much wine the night before, but at least he was spared the lecturing wife. Peter's breakfast came. Beeson, his chief warder, who had a hangover of his own, fetched him plain bran cereal with no sugar, watery milk that was rapidly souring, and more of the coarse, salty bread. This was a bitter contrast to the pleasant breakfasts Peter had enjoyed in his study, and he ate none of it. At 11, one of the lesser warders fetched it silently away. "Young princeling means to starve, thinks I," he said to Beeson. "Good," Beeson replied indifferently. "Spare us the trouble of keeping him."
"Maybe he fears poison,"
the lesser warder ventured, and in spite of his aching head, Beeson laughed. The jest was a good one. Peter spent most of his day in the sitting room chair. In the later part of the afternoon, he stood at the window again. The window was not barred. Unless you were a bird, there was nowhere to go but straight down. No one, not Pena, not Flagg, not Aaron Beeson, worried that the prisoner might somehow climb down. The needle's curving stone wall was utterly smooth. A fly might have done it, but not a man. And if he grew depressed enough to jump, would anyone care? Not much. It would save the state the expense of feeding and housing a blue-blooded murderer. As the sun began to move across the floor and up the wall, Peter sat and watched it. His dinner, more fatty meat, watery ale, and salty bread, came. Peter did not touch it. When the sun was gone, he sat in the dark until 9 and then went into the bedroom. He stripped to his singlet, knelt, and prayed with small white puffs coming from his mouth. He got into bed, laced his hands behind his head, and lay on his back, staring up into the darkness. He lay there thinking about what had become of him. Around 1 o'clock in the morning, he slept. So he was on the second day, and the third, and the fourth. For a full week, Peter ate nothing, spoke nothing, and did nothing but stand at his sitting room window or sit in his chair, watching the sun crawl across the floor and then up the wall to the ceiling. Beeson was convinced that the boy was in an utter blackness of guilt and despair. He had seen such things before, especially among royalty. The boy would die, he thought, like a wild bird that was never meant to be caged. The boy would die, and good riddance to him. But on the eighth day, Peter sent for Aaron Beeson and gave him certain instructions, and he did not give them like a prisoner. He gave them like a king. 52. Peter did feel despair, but it was not as deep as Beeson believed. He spent that first week in the needle carefully thinking out his position and trying to decide what he should do. He had fasted to clear his head. Eventually it did clear, but for a while he felt terribly lost, and the weight of his situation pressed down on his head like a blacksmith's anvil. Then he remembered one simple truth. He knew he hadn't killed his father, even if everyone else in the kingdom thought he had. During the first day or two, he grappled with useless feelings. The childish part of him kept crying out, "Not fair, this is not fair!" And of course it wasn't, but that sort of thinking got him no place. As he fasted, he began to regain control of himself. His empty belly peeled the childish part of him away. He began to feel cleaner, husked out, empty, like a glass waiting to be filled. After 2 or 3 days of eating nothing, the growlings in his stomach subsided, and he began to hear his real thoughts more clearly. He prayed, but part of him knew that he was doing more than praying. He was talking to himself, listening to himself, wondering if there was a way out of this prison in the sky where he had been so neatly put. He had not killed his father. That was the first thing. Someone had blamed it on him. That was the second thing. Who? There was only one person who could have, of course. Only one person in all of Delane who could have had such an awful poison as dragon sand. Flag. It made perfect sense. Flag knew he would have no place in a kingdom ruled by Peter. Flag had been careful to make Thomas his friend, and to make Thomas fear him. Somehow Flag had murdered Roland and then arranged the evidence which had sent Peter here. He was this far by the third night of Thomas's reign. Then what was he to do? Simply accept? No, he wouldn't do that. Escape? He couldn't do that. No one had ever escaped from the needle, except... A glimmer came to him. This was on the fourth night as he looked at his dinner tray. Fatty meat, watery ale, salty bread, a plain white plate, no napkin. Except. The glimmer grew brighter. There might be a way to escape. There might. It would be horribly dangerous, and it would be long. At the end of much work, he might only die in spite of all his efforts, but there might be a way, and if he did escape, what then? Was there a way to bring the murder home to the magician? Peter did not know. Flag was a wily old serpent. He would have left no evidence of what he had done to damn him later on. Could Peter worm a confession out of the magician? He might be able to, always assuming Peter could lay hands on him in the first place. Peter guessed that Flag might disappear like smoke if he heard that Peter had escaped the needle. Would anyone believe Flag's confession, even if Peter could get one out of him? Oh, yes, he confessed to the murder of Roland, people would say. Peter the escaped father-killer had a sword to his throat. In a fix like that, I might confess to anything, even the murder of God.
You might be tempted to laugh at Peter, turning such things over in his mind while he was still imprisoned 300 feet in the sky. You might say he had gotten the cart quite a bit forward of the horse, but Peter had seen a way he might escape. It might, of course, only be a way to die young, but he thought it had a chance of working. Still, was there any reason to go through all the work if in the end it could come to nothing? Or worse still, if it were to cause the kingdom fresh harm in some way he did not see now? He thought about these things and prayed over them. The fourth night passed, the fifth, the sixth. On the seventh night, Peter came to this conclusion. It was better to try than not to try. Better to make an effort to right the wrong, even if he died trying to do so. An injustice had been done. He discovered a strange thing. The fact that the injustice had been done to him didn't seem half so important as the fact that it had been done at all. It ought to be righted. On the eighth day of Thomas's reign, he sent for Beeson. 53. Beeson listened to the speech of the imprisoned prince with incredulity and mounting rage. Peter finished, and Aaron Beeson let loose a gutter flood of obscenity that would have made a horse drover blush. Peter stood before it, impassive.
"You murdering, snot-nosed hound," Beeson finished in a tone that was close to wonder. "I guess you think you're still living in the bloody lap of luxury with your servants to run scurrying every time you lift one of your perfumed little fingers. But it ain't like that in here, my young prince. No, sir."
Beeson leaned forward from the waist, scruffy chin jutting, and although the stench of the man, sweat and thick cheap wine and great gray scales of dirt, was nearly overpowering, Peter did not give ground. There were no bars between them. Beeson had yet to fear a prisoner, and certainly he felt no fear of this young whelp. The chief warder was 50, short, broad of shoulder, deep in the gut. His greasy hair hung in tangles around his cheeks and down the back of his neck. When he had come into Peter's room, one of the lesser warders had locked the door behind them. Beeson balled his left hand into a fist and shook it under Peter's nose. His right hand slid into the pouch pocket of his shirt and closed around a smooth cylinder of metal. One hard smash with that loaded fist would break a man's jaw. Beeson had done it before.
"You take your requests, and you jam them up your nose with the rest of the boogers, my dear little prince. And the next time you call me in here for any such royal rubbish as this, you'll bleed for it."
Beeson started away toward the door, short and hunched over and almost troll-like. He traveled in his own tight little cloud of stink. "You are in danger of making an extremely bad mistake," Peter said. His voice was soft but grim, and it carried. Beeson turned back to him, his face incredulous.
"What did you say?"
"You heard me," Peter said, "and when you speak to me next, you stinking little turnip, I think you had better remember you are speaking to royalty, don't you? My lineage did not change when I climbed those steps." For a moment, Beeson could not reply. His mouth opened and closed like the mouth of a fish yanked out of the ocean, although any fisherman catching something as ugly as Beeson would surely have thrown it back. Peter's cool requests delivered in a tone which made it clear that they were in reality demands not to be refused, made Beeson's head buzz with fury. One of the requests had been that of either an utter sissy or an outright lunatic. That one Beeson had dismissed at once as nonsense and tomfoolery. The other, however, had to do with his meals. That, combined with the firm, resolute look in Peter's eye, suggested that the young prince had thrown off his despair and meant to live. The future prospects for idle days and drunken nights had looked bright. Now they had dimmed again. This young boy looked very healthy, very strong. He might live a long time. Beeson might very well have to look at the young murderer's face for the rest of his own life. There was a thought to set a man's teeth on edge, and...
Stinking turnip? Did he actually call me a stinking turnip?
"Oh, my dear little prince," Beeson said, "I think you are the one who has made the mistake, but I can promise you'll never make it again."
His lips split open in a grin, revealing a few blackened stumps of teeth. Now, about to attack, he moved with surprising grace. His right hand came out of the pouch pocket wrapped around the bar of metal. Peter took a step backward, his eyes moving from Beeson's fisted hands to Beeson's face and then back to his fists. Behind Beeson, the tiny barred window in the middle of Peter's door was opened. Two of the lesser warders were crammed there, cheek to stubbly cheek, grinning and waiting for the fun to start. "You know that royal prisoners are to be given some consideration in smaller matters," Peter said, still backtracking and circling. "That is tradition, and I have asked you for nothing untoward." Beeson's grin widened. He imagined he heard fear in Peter's voice. He was mistaken. This error would shortly be brought home to him in a way to which he was unaccustomed.
"Such traditions are paid for, even among the royalty, my little prince."
Beeson rubbed his left thumb and finger together. His right fist remained tightly balled around the chunk of metal. "If you mean you wish an odd bit of cash from time to time, that might be arranged," Peter said, continuing to circle away. "But only if you drop this foolish behavior of yours right now."
"Afraid, are you?"
"If anyone should be afraid here, I think it is you," Peter said. "You apparently mean to attack the brother of the King of Delane." This shot struck home, and for a moment Beeson faltered. His eyes grew uncertain. Then he glanced toward the open window and the door, saw the faces of his lesser warders, and his own face darkened again. If he drew back now, he would have trouble with them. Nothing he couldn't handle, of course, but still more annoyance than this little stinker was worth. He moved forward in a rush and swung the weighted fist. He was grinning. The prince's screams as he fell to the stone floor with his smashed and squirting nose clutched in his hands would be, Beeson thought, shrill and babyish. Peter moved back easily, his feet moving as gracefully as if in a dance. He seized Beeson's fist and was not surprised in the least by its weight. He had seen the gleam of metal between Beeson's swelled fingers. Peter pulled with a wiry strength that Beeson would not have believed 5 minutes ago. He spun through the air and hit the curving inner wall of Peter's sitting room with a crash that rattled the few teeth remaining in his jaws. Stars exploded in his head. The metal cylinder flew from his fist and rolled across the floor, and before Beeson could even begin to recover, Peter had sprung after it and seized it. He moved with the simple, pure liquidity of a cat. "This can't be happening," Beeson thought with dawning dismay and stupid surprise. "This absolutely can't be happening." He had never feared entering the two-room prison at the top of the Needle, because there had never been a prisoner here, not of noble blood, not of royal blood, who could best him. Oh, there had been some famous fights up here, but he had taught them all who was boss. Perhaps they ruled the roost down below, but up here he was the boss, and they came to respect his dirty, compact power. But now this stripling of a boy. Bellowing with rage, Beeson came off the wall, shaking his head to clear it, and charged Peter, who had folded the cylinder of metal into his own right hand. The lesser warder stood staring at this unexpected development with stupid wonder. Neither thought of interfering. They could believe what was happening no more than Beeson himself. Beeson ran at Peter with his arms outstretched. Now that the prince had gotten his fist weight away from him, Beeson had no more interest in the sort of free-for-all swinging and hitting he thought of as boxing. He meant to close with Peter, grapple with him, drive him to the floor, land on top of him, and then choke him unconscious. But the space where Peter had been emptied with magical suddenness as the boy stepped aside and dropped into a crouch. As the squat, troll-like chief warder went past, trying to turn, Peter hit him 3 times with his right fist, which was closed around the metal cylinder. "Hardly fair," Peter thought, "but then it wasn't I that brought this piece of metal into it, was it?" The blows did not look hard at all. If Beeson had been watching a fight and had seen those 3 quick, fluttering punches thrown, he would have laughed and called them sissy punches. Beeson's idea of a real man's punch was a roundhouse blow that made the air whistle. But they weren't sissy punches at all, no matter what the likes of Beeson might have thought. Each was driven out from the shoulder, just as Peter's boxing instructor had taught him in their twice-weekly classes over the last 6 years. The punches were economical. They didn't make the air whistle. But Beeson felt as if he had been kicked 3 times in rapid succession by a very small pony with very big hoofs. There was a flare of agony across the left side of his face as his cheekbone broke.
To Beeson, it sounded as if a small branch had snapped inside his head. He was driven into the wall again. He hit it like a rag doll and bounced back buckle-kneed. He stared at the prince with obvious dismay. The lesser warders peering through the hole in the door were agog with surprise. Beeson being beaten by a boy? It was as unbelievable as rain would have been coming down from a clear blue sky. One of them now looked at the key in his hand, thought briefly of going in there, then thought better of it. A man could get hurt in there. He slipped the key into his pocket, where he could later claim to have forgotten it. Are you ready to talk reasonably now? Peter wasn't even out of breath. This is silly. I require only two small favors of you, favors for which you can count on being well and amply repaid. You— With a roar, Beeson flung himself at Peter again. This time Peter was not expecting an attack, but he managed to pull back anyway, the way a matador pulls back from a bull which charges unexpectedly. The matador may be surprised, perhaps even gored, but he rarely loses his grace. Peter did not lose his, but he was wounded. Beeson's nails were long, ragged, and filthy, more like animal claws than human nails, and he liked to tell his lesser warders, on dark winter's nights when a gruesome tale seemed required, about the time he had slit a prisoner's neck from ear to ear with one of those thumbnails. Now one drew a bloody line down Peter's left cheek as Beeson flailed his way by. The cut zigzagged from temple to jawline, missing Peter's left eye by hardly half an inch. Peter's cheek fell open in a flap, and all his life he would bear the scar of his encounter with Beeson there. Peter grew angry. All the things that had happened to him over the last 10 days seemed to slam together in his head, and for a moment he was almost, not quite, but almost, angry enough to kill the brutish chief warder instead of just teaching him a lesson he would never, never forget. As Beeson turned, he was rocked by left hooks and right jabs. The jabs would ordinarily have done little damage, but the pound and a half of metal in Peter's fist turned them into torpedoes. His knuckles sprung Beeson's jaw. Beeson roared with pain and again tried to close with Peter. This was a mistake. There was a crunch as his nose broke and blood flooded over his mouth and chin. It dripped onto his filthy jerkin. Then a bright flare of pain as that heavy right hand smashed his lips back. Beeson spat a tooth onto the floor and tried to circle away. He had forgotten that his lesser warders were watching, afraid to interfere. Beeson had forgotten his anger at the young prince's attitude, had lost his former desire to teach the young prince a lesson. For the first time in his tenure as chief warder, he had forgotten everything but a blind desire to survive. For the first time in his tenure as chief warder, Beeson was afraid. Nor was it the fact that Peter was now punching him at will that frightened him. He had taken bad beatings before, although never at the hands of a prisoner. No, it was the look in Peter's eyes that had so terrified him. It is the look of a king. Gods protect me, it is the face of a king. His fury blazes almost with the heat of the sun. Peter drove Beeson against the wall, measured the distance to Beeson's chin, and then drew back his weighted right fist. Do you need more convincing, Turnip? Peter asked grimly.
No more,
Beeson replied groggily through his rapidly puffing lips.
No more, my king. I cry your mercy. I cry your mercy.
What? Peter asked, flabbergasted. What did you call me? But Beeson was sliding slowly down the curved stone wall. When he had called Peter my king, he had done so as unconsciousness stole over him. He would not remember saying it, but Peter never forgot. 54. Beeson was unconscious for over 2 hours. If not for his thick, snoring breaths, Peter would have been afraid that perhaps he really had killed the chief warder. The man was a gross, vicious, underhanded pig. But for all of that, Peter had no wish to kill him. The lesser warders took turns, staring in the little window in the oaken door, their eyes wide and round, the eyes of small boys looking at the man-eating Anduin tiger in the king's menagerie. Neither made any effort to rescue their superior, and their faces told Peter that they expected him to leap on the unconscious Beeson at any moment and tear his throat out, perhaps with his teeth. Well, why shouldn't they think such things? Peter asked himself bitterly. They think I killed my own father, and a man who would do such a thing might stoop to any low act, even that of killing an unconscious opponent. Finally, Beeson began to moan and stir. His right eye fluttered and came open.
The left couldn't open and wouldn't completely for some days. The right eye looked at Peter not with hate, but with unmistakable alarm. "Are you ready to speak reasonably?" Peter asked. Beeson said something Peter couldn't understand. It sounded like mush. "I don't understand you." Beeson tried again.
"You could have killed me."
"I've never killed anyone," Peter said. "The time may come when I'll have to, but if it ever does, I hope I don't have to start with unconscious warders." Beeson sat against the wall, looking at Peter with his one open eye. An expression of deep thought, absurd and a little frightening on his swelled and battered features, settled over his face. At last he managed another mushy phrase. Peter thought he understood this one, but wanted to be absolutely sure. "Repeat that, please, Mr. Chief Warder Beeson." Beeson looked startled. As Joseph had never been called Lord High Groom before Peter, so Beeson had never been called Mr. Chief Warder.
"We can do business," he said.
"That is very well." Beeson struggled slowly to his feet. He wanted no more to do with Peter, at least not today. He had other problems. His lesser warders had just watched him take a bad beating at the hands of a boy who hadn't had anything to eat for a week. Watched, and no more, the cowardly sots. His head ached, and he might well have to whip those poor fools into line before he could slink off to bed. He had started out when Peter called to him. Beeson turned back. That turning was really all it took. Both of them knew who was in charge here. Beeson had been beaten. When his prisoner told him to wait, he waited. "I have something I want to say to you. It will be good for both of us if I do." Beeson said nothing. He only stood and watched Peter warily. "Tell them," Peter jerked his head toward the door, "to close the spy hole." Beeson stared at Peter for a moment, then turned toward the staring warders and gave the command. The lesser warders, currently jammed cheek to cheek into the opening, stood there staring, not understanding Beeson's blurred words, or pretending not to. Beeson ran his tongue over his blood-flecked teeth and spoke more clearly, obviously with some pain. This time the peephole was swung shut and bolted from the outside, but not before Beeson had heard the contemptuous laughter of his underlings. He sighed wearily. Yes, they would have to be taught some hard lessons before he could go home. Cowards learned quickly, though. This prince, whatever else he might be, was surely no coward. He wondered if he really wanted to do any business at all with Peter. "I want to give you a note to take to Anders Pena," Peter said. "You'll come back for it tonight, I hope." Beeson said nothing, but he was trying very hard to think. This was the most unsettling twist yet. Pena. A note to Pena. He had had a cold moment when Peter reminded him that he was the brother of the king, but it had been nothing compared with this. Pena, by the gods! The more he thought of it, the less he liked it. King Thomas might not much care if his older brother was roughed up in the needle. The older brother had murdered their father, for one thing. Thomas probably didn't feel much brotherly love right now. And more important, Beeson felt little or no fright when the name of King Thomas the Lightbringer was invoked. Like almost everyone else in Delane, Beeson had already begun to view Thomas with a certain contempt. But Pena, now, Pena was different. To the likes of Beeson, Anders Pena was more frightening than a whole marching regiment of kings anyway. A king was a distant sort of being, bright and mysterious like the sun. It didn't matter if the sun went behind the clouds and froze you, or came out all hot and white to bake you alive. Either way, you only accepted because what the sun did was far beyond the ability of mortal creatures to understand or to change. Pena was a more earthly being, the sort of being Beeson could understand and fear. Pena with his narrow face and his ice-blue eyes. Pena with his high-collared judge's robes. Pena who decided who would live and who would go under the headsman's axe. Could this boy really command Pena from his cell here at the top of the needle? Or was it only a desperate bluff? How can it be a bluff if he means to write him a note I shall myself deliver? If I were king, Pena would have served me in any way I commanded, Peter said. I am not a king now, only a prisoner. Still, not long ago I did him a favor for which I think he is very grateful. I see, Beeson replied as noncommittally as he could. Peter sighed. Suddenly he felt very weary and wondered what sort of foolish dream he was pursuing here. Did he really believe he was taking the first few steps on the road to freedom by beating up this stupid warder and then bending him to his will? Did he have any real guarantee that Pena would do even the smallest thing for him? Perhaps the concept of a favor owed was only in Peter's own mind. But it had to be tried. Hadn't he decided on his long, lonely nights of meditation as he grieved for both his father and himself that the only real sin would be in not trying? Pena is not my friend, Peter went on. I won't even try to tell you that he is. I've been convicted of murdering my father, the king, and I shouldn't think I have a friend left in all of Delane, from north to south. Would you agree, Mr. Chief Warder Beeson?
Yes, Beeson said stonily. I would.
Nevertheless, I believe that Pena will undertake to provide you with the bit of cash you are used to receiving from your inmates. Beeson nodded. When a noble was imprisoned in the Needle for any length of time, Beeson would commonly see that the prisoner got a better grade of food than the fatty meat and watery ale, fresh linen once a week, and sometimes a visit from a wife or a sweetheart. He did not do this free, of course. Imprisoned nobles almost always came from rich families, and there was always someone in those families willing to pay Beeson for Beeson's services, no matter what the crime had been. This crime was of an exceptionally terrible nature, but here was this boy saying that no less a one than Anders Pena might be willing to provide the bribe.
One other thing, Peter said softly. I believe Pena will do this because he is a man of honor, and if anything were to happen to me, if you and several of your lesser warders were to rush in here tonight and beat me in revenge for the beating I have given you, for example, I believe that Pena might take an interest in the matter.
Peter paused.
A personal interest in the matter.
He looked closely at Beeson. Do you understand me?
Yes,
Beeson said, and then added,
My lord.
Will you provide me with pen, inkpot, blotter, and paper?
Yes.
Come here. With some trepidation, Beeson came. The chief warder's stink was tremendous, but Peter did not draw away. The stink of the crime with which he had been accused had almost inured him to the smell of sweat and dirt he had discovered. He looked at Beeson with a hint of a smile.
Whisper in my ear, Peter said.
Beeson blinked uneasily.
What shall I whisper, my lord?
A number, Peter said. After a moment, Beeson did. 55. One of the lesser warders brought Peter the writing implements he had asked for. He gave Peter the wary look of an alley cat that has been often kicked, and skittered away before he could receive a helping of the anger that had been heaped on Beeson's head. Peter sat down at the rickety table by the window, breath puffing out in the deep cold. He listened to the restless whine of the wind around the tip of the needle and looked down at the lights of the city. Dear Judge General Pena, he wrote, and then stopped. Will you see who this is from? Crumple it in your hand and throw it into the fire unread? Would you read it and then laugh contemptuously at the fool who murdered his father and then dared to expect help from the judge general of the land? Will you perhaps even see through the scheme and understand what it is I'm up to? Peter was in a cheerier frame of mind that evening and thought the answer to all three questions would probably be no. His plan might well fail, but it was unlikely to be foreseen by such an orderly and methodical man as Pena. The judge general would be as apt to imagine himself donning a dress and dancing a hornpipe in the plaza of the Needle at the full of the moon as he was to guess what Peter was up to. And what I'm asking is so little, Peter thought. That ghost of a smile touched his lips again. At least I hope and believe it will seem so. To him. Bending forward, he dipped the quill pen in the inkpot and began to write. 56. On the following evening, shortly after 9 had struck, Anders Pena's butler answered an unaccustomedly late knock and looked down his long nose at the figure of the chief warder standing on the doorstep. Arlen, that was the butler's name, had seen Beeson before, of course. Like Arlen's master, Beeson was a part of the kingdom's legal machinery. But Arlen did not recognize him now. The beating Peter had given Beeson had had a day to set, and his face was a sunset of reds and purples and yellows. His left eye had opened a little, but was still little more than a slit. He looked like a dwarfish ghoul, and the butler began to swing the door shut almost at once.
"Wait," Beeson said in a hard growl that made the butler hesitate. "I come with a message for your master."
The butler hesitated for a moment and then began to swing the door closed again. The man's sullen, swollen face was frightening. Could he actually be a dwarf down from the North Country? Supposedly the last of those wild, fur-clad tribes had either died or been killed off in his grandfather's time, but still, one never knew.
"It is from Prince Peter," Beeson said. "If you close this door, you will hear hard things later from your master, thinks I."
Arlen hesitated again, torn between closing the door against the ghoul and the power the name of Prince Peter still held. If this man came from Peter, he must be the Needle's chief warder, yet...
"You don't look like Beeson," he said.
"You don't look like your father neither, Arlen, and it's made me wonder more than once where your mother may have been."
The lumpish ghoul retorted rudely and stuck a smudged envelope through the crack still open in the door.
"Here, take it to him. I'll wait. Close the door if you want, although it's devilish cold out here."
Arlen didn't care if it was 20 below. He didn't intend to have the horrible-looking fellow toasting his feet in front of the fire in the servant's kitchen. He snatched the envelope, shut the door, bolted it, started away, then returned and double-bolted it. 57. Pena was in his study, staring into the fire and thinking long thoughts. When Thomas had been crowned, the moon had been new. It was not yet at the half, and already he did not like the way things were going. Flag, that was the worst. Flag. The magician already wielded more power than in the days of Roland's reign. Roland had at least been a man, full of years, no matter how slow his thinking might have been. Thomas was only a boy, and Pena feared that Flag might soon control all Delane and Thomas's name. That would be bad for the kingdom, and bad for Anders Pena, who had never concealed his dislike of Flag. It was pleasant here in the study, before the crackling fire, but Pena thought he nonetheless felt a cold wind around his ankles. It was a wind which might rise and blow away everything. Why, Peter? Why, oh, why? Why couldn't you wait? And why did you have to seem so perfect on the outside, like a rose-red apple in autumn, and be so rotten below the skin? Why? Pena didn't know, and would not admit to himself, even now, that doubts as to whether or not Peter really had been rotten were beginning to nibble at his heart. There was a knock at the door. Pena roused himself, looked around, and called out impatiently,
"Come, and it better be damned good!"
Arlen came in, looking ruffled and confused. He held an envelope in one hand.
"Well?"
"My lord, there's a man at the door. At least he looks like a man. That is, his face is most awfully puffed and swelled, as if he had gotten a terrible beating, or..."
Arlen's voice trailed away.
"What's that to do with me? You know I don't receive this late. Tell him to go away. Tell him to go to the devil."
"He says he's Beeson, my lord,"
Arlen said, more flustered than ever. He raised the smudged envelope as if to use it as a shield.
"He brought this. He says it's a message from Prince Peter."
Pena's heart leaped at that, but he only frowned more strenuously at Arlen.
"Well, is it?
From Prince Peter?"
Arlen was almost gibbering now. His usual composure was utterly lost, and Pena found this interesting. He wouldn't have believed Arlen would lose his composure come fire, flood, or invasion of ravaging dragons.
"My lord, I would have no way of knowing. That is, I...
"Is it Beeson, you idiot?"
Arlen licked his lips. Actually licked his lips. This was utterly unheard of.
"Well, it might be, my lord. It looks a bit like him. But the fellow on the doorstep is most awfully bruised and lumpy.
Arlen swallowed.
"I thought he looked like a dwarf,"
he said, bringing out the worst and then trying to soften it with a lame smile.
It is Beeson, Pena thought. It's Beeson, and if he looks as if he's been beaten, it's because Peter administered the beating. That's why he brought the message, because Peter beat him and he was afraid not to. Beating's the only thing that convinces his sort. There came a sudden feeling of exultation in Pena's heart. He felt as one might feel in a dark cave when a light suddenly shines out.
Give me the letter, he said.
Arlen did. He then made as if to scuttle out, and this was also something new, because Arlen did not scuttle. At least, Pena thought, his mind lawyerly as always. I have never known him to scuttle. He let Arlen get as far as the study door, as a veteran fisherman will let a hooked fish run, and then pulled him up short.
Arlen!
Arlen turned back. He looked braced, as if to receive a reprimand.
There are no more dwarves. Did your mother not tell you so?
Yes,
Arlen said reluctantly.
Good for her. A wise woman. These dreams in your head must have come from your father. Let the chief warder in. To the servants' kitchen, he added hastily. I have no wish to have him in here. He stinks. But let him into the servants' kitchen so he may warm himself. The night is cold.
Since the death of Roland, Pena reflected, all the nights had been cold, as if in reproach for the way the old king had burned from the inside out.
Yes, my lord,
Arlen said with marked reluctance.
I'll ring for you shortly and tell you what to do with him.
Arlen went out, a humbled man, and closed the door behind him. Pena turned the envelope over in his hand several times without opening it. The dirt was no doubt from Beeson's own greasy fingers. He could almost smell the villain's sweat on the envelope. It had been sealed shut with a blot of common candle wax. He thought, I would do better, perhaps, to throw this directly into the fire and think of it no more. Yes, throw it into the fire, then ring Arlen and tell him to give the little hunched-over chief warder. He really does look like a dwarf, now that I think of it. A hot toddy and send him away. Yes, that is what I should do. But he knew that he wouldn't. That absurd feeling, that feeling that here was a ray of light in hopeless darkness, would not leave him. He put his thumb under the flap of the envelope, broke the seal, took out a brief letter, and read it by firelight. 58. Pena. I have decided to live. I had read only a little about the needle before I actually found myself in the place, and although I had heard a bit more, most of it was only gossip. One of the things I heard was that certain small favors might be purchased. It seems this really is so. I, of course, have no money, but I thought you might perhaps defray my expenses in this matter. I did you a favor not long ago, and if you were to pay the chief warder a sum of 8 guilders, such sum to be paid anew at the beginning of each year I spend in this unhappy place, I would consider the favor repaid. This sum, you will notice, is very small. That is because I require only 2 things. If you will arrange for Beeson to wet his beak so that I may have them, I'll trouble you no more. I am aware that you would be put in a bad light if it came out that you have helped me, even in a small way. I suggest that you make my friend Ben your go-between, if you decide to do as I ask. I have not spoken to Ben since my arrest, but I think and hope he remains true to me. I would ask him rather than you, but the Stads are not well off, and Ben has no money of his own. It shames me to ask money from anyone, but there is no other to whom I may turn. If you feel you cannot do as I request, I will understand. I did not murder my father. Peter. 59. Pena looked at this amazing letter for quite some time. His eyes kept returning to the first line and the last. I have decided to live. I did not murder my father. It did not surprise him that the boy continued to protest. He had known criminals to go on for years and years protesting their innocence of crimes of which they were patently guilty. But it was not like a guilty man to be so bald in his own defense, so commanding. Yes. That was what bothered him most about the letter, its tone of command. A true king, Pena felt, would not be changed by exile, not by prison, not even by torture. A true king would not waste time justifying or explaining. He would simply state his will. I have decided to live. Pain aside. After a long time, he drew his inkpot to him, took a sheet of fine parchment from his drawer, and wrote upon it. His note was even shorter than Peter's had been. It took him less than 5 minutes to write it, blot it, sand it, fold it, and seal it shut. With that done, he rang for Arlen. Arlen, looking much chastened, appeared almost at once.
"Is Beeson still here?" Pena asked. "I think so, sir," Arlen said.
In fact, he knew Beeson was still there because he had been peeking through the keyhole at the man, watching him lurch back and forth restlessly from one end of the servant's kitchen to the other with a cold chicken leg clutched like a club in one hand. When the meat on the leg was all gone, Beeson had crunched the bones, horrible splintering sounds they made, and sucked contentedly at the marrow. Arlen was still not utterly convinced the man was not a dwarf, perhaps even a troll.
"Give him this," Pena said, handing Arlen the note, "and this for his treble."
2 guilders clinked into Arlen's other hand. "Tell him there may be a reply. If so, he's to bring it at night, as he did this one."
"Yes, my lord."
"Don't linger and chat with him either," Pena said. It was as close as he was able to come to making a joke.
"No, my lord,"
Arlen said glumly and went out. He was still thinking of the crunching sounds that chicken bones had made when Beeson bit through them. 60.
"Here,"
Beeson said grumpily when he came into Peter's cell the next day, thrusting the envelope at Peter. In truth, he felt grumpy. The 2 guilders handed to him by Arlen had been an unexpected windfall, and Beeson had spent most of the night drinking it up. 2 guilders bought a great lot of mead, and today his head felt large and very painful.
"Damned messenger boy is what I'm turning into."
"Thank you," Peter said, holding the envelope.
"Well, ain't you gonna open it?"
"Yes, when you leave." Beeson bared his teeth and clenched his fists. Peter simply stood there looking at him. After a moment, Beeson lowered his fists.
"Damned messenger boy is all," he repeated and went out, slamming the heavy door behind him.
There was the thud of iron locks being turned, followed by the sliding sound of bolts, 3 of them, each as thick as Peter's wrist, being slid into place. When the sounds had stopped, Peter opened the note. It was only 3 sentences long. "I am aware of the long-standing customs of which you speak. The sum you mentioned could be arranged. I will do so, but not until I know what favors you expect to buy from our mutual friend." Peter smiled. Judge General Pena was not a sly man. Slyness was not at all in his nature as it was in Flag's. But he was exceedingly careful. This note was the proof of that. Peter had expected Pena's condition. He would have felt wary if Pena had not asked what he wanted. Ben would be the go-between. Pena would cease to actually be a part of the bribe very shortly, but still he walked carefully, as a man might walk on loose stones which might slide out from under his feet at any moment. Peter went to the door of his cell, rapped, and after some conversation with Beeson, was given the inkpot and dirty quill pen again. Beeson did more muttering about being nothing but a damned messenger boy, but he was not really unhappy about the situation. There might be another 2 guilders in this for him.
"If them 2 write back and forth long enough, I guess I could get richer arter it,"
he said to no one at all, and roared laughter in spite of his aching head.